I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking this hour with Sheila Robotham. She is the author of many books, including Edward Carpenter, A Life of Liberty and Love, and Dreamers of a New Day, Women Who Invented the 20th Century, published by Verso Books. We're talking about those dreamers today on the program. Sheila teaches gender and labor history at the University of Manchester. Clearly, women's sexuality and control over reproduction is a fundamental part of their emancipation, and hence the women of this era took these issues up. And you have spoken earlier in the hour about free love and women who are trying to define their sexual and personal relationships. I wonder if you could talk about the campaigns to help women control their fertility through contraception.
Yes, as I said, you know, the free love idea was voluntary motherhood, and that was also a view that some of the early feminists were interested in, the idea that women should simply have the power to say no to their husbands and choose who they would live with and when they would have any kind of sexual relations. But there was also the idea of changing women's experience of sex through the reliability of contraception, and that idea is coming along through the 19th century. The person who really propagates that is the young Margaret Sanger, who was worked in New York as a nurse and midwife, and saw the conditions that women were in, and became an early advocate of birth control. She really creates the concept of birth control through linking control over sexuality and sexual life to ideas that were around in the left about workers' control. So she's this idea that women should control their own bodies is coming in through Margaret Sanger and her equivalents in Britain. Particularly a woman she got friendly with, who was from Canada living in Britain, called Stella Brown, who was also interested in this link between the control over the body and control over the workplace.
And yet the cause of contraception was a complicated one, in that in many cases they were tied to Malthusian or neo-Malthusian ideas about the need to control population as a way of controlling poverty rather than looking at the causes of social causes of poverty. And then also the movement towards eugenics of controlling who reproduced and encouraging upper-class women, white women, to have children, and discouraging, or in cases sterilizing, working class or poor women or women of color.
Yeah, so the eugenic ideas appear in among the free lovers in terms of talking that Moses Harman talks about the right to be born well. And there had been within the utopian communities ideas about eugenic breeding, which were developed by the male leaders, so that the notion of who was a superior person was modelled on the male leader of the community, and those ideas pass into more mainstream circles from the late 1890s and into the 20th century. So, and they pervade not only the right but also the left. So people were talking about, you know, women's right to refuse birth on the grounds that women would be deciding, you know, they're having this sort of eugenic power over birth. So there's it goes into the left and into the feminist movement, as well as into right-wing circles where people are talking about the need to breed an imperial race.
One of the things that came out of this era was the emergence of home economics, which for us now, with our jaundiced perspective from the beginning of the 21st century, doesn't have a very appealing ring to it, but actually at the time had liberatory hopes attached to it. Tell us about the whole notion of home economics and the rise of it.
It's extraordinary because I must say I hated when I was at school having to do cookery and needlework, which was the sort of remains of home economics. And we even had an ancient wood burning, you know, great big sort of range when I was at school in the 1950s that was left over from the 1920s. And we had to do diagrams of the flues and everything in it.
Sounds dreadful.
All this domestic stuff. But reading about the history of these women who had this very broad vision of home economics as extending outwards into things that we would connect with environmental ecological concerns, home economics has not just been about whether you wash the glasses up before the forks and the pots, but things to do with how the home relates to the outside world. So they went off and tested the scum on the ponds and looked at things which really we have now as an idea of ecology.
And yet, as with, I guess, everything under capitalism sooner or later, by the 1920s, a lot of the hopes and directions of women who had struggled during this era became seen as a new market for consumption. And of course, it corresponded in the 1920s with a great boom of consumption. You had mentioned cooperatives and exchanges and vegetarian cafes where people could feel like they might have a space as women to participate in public life unmolested. But tell us about the other side of the new woman as being a new market.
There were ideas developing of alternative kinds of consumption. So the co-op in Britain did put forward ideas about the possibility of having, you know, cooperative biscuits and cooperative tennis clubs and cooperative everything. But they do get beaten back by the commercial interests, which are really coming up. In the United States, by the 1920s, the marketing of goods and the advertising is a really, really big industry. And a woman who writes about household consumption, also called Christine Frederick, also talked about the beauty industry and noted that actually one of the things that they were already selling in the 1920s was the idea of nature. That you would look more natural by, you know, buying all these cosmetics. She developed the idea that you could make the home into a kind of scientific zone. There were ideas developing an industry for scientific management, and with those went some theories which were developed also by some women of what we now call ergonomics or in a human-centered design, so that people could easily reach for things and not use that much energy, not exhaust themselves. So there was an attempt to design workplaces. Employers were not so interested in this ergonomic design, but some of the socially minded women were, and they took these ideas into kitchen design. So there was a whole emphasis in Christine Frederick's writing on the perfectly designed kitchen with all these labour-saving appliances. The snag with them, of course, was that you had to spend ages finding out what they were and going off to buy them. And it did assume that you were a wealthy housewife. The great difference between Britain and America was that in America, there was a problem about finding servants because the wages were much higher and women preferred to work in industry and certainly not go into domestic service. In Britain, in the 1920s, unemployment was quite high and the women who'd had high wages in the war were forced to go back to be domestic servants. So there wasn't so much impetus to bring in this new technology and redesign of the household in Britain as there was in the United States.
That is the voice of Sheila Robotham. She teaches gender and labour history at the University of Manchester and is the author of Dreamers of a New Day. What was the relationship between women who were trying to redefine their position, and whether it was entering the workforce or being able to actually get decent wages? What was their relationship with the mainstream of trade unionism in the US and the UK?
In the late 19th century, women were still excluded from quite a lot of the male craft unions. And in Britain, they started a separate group called the Women's Trade Union League, which sometimes worked with the male unions that did admit women, but otherwise tried to organise women into separate unions. And the same idea was adopted in the United States. There'd been various struggles within the unions in the States in which the men remained extremely suspicious of women who they thought were going to undercut them. So they saw women always as this sort of potential flood of cheap labour and had this idea that what you should do is keep them out. The women who organised came into conflict around that issue. And then the next issue that really came into divided women themselves who were trying to work for emancipation was the question of whether women should argue for complete equality with men or whether they should give their backing to protective legislation which would try to improve the conditions of women with the hope that those conditions would then be extended to men, but invariably they weren't, and they tended to create a separate labour market in which women were protected by legislation, which also meant that they couldn't get into an equal position as men at work. So there was a big tussle around those two views, and of course that argument was to go on certainly into the 1930s.
You wrote a memoir about the 1960s called Promise of a Dream, and it seems to me that the spirit of the New Left and of feminist hopes very much is alive in this book, and one can't help making comparisons between the two. Were you attracted to these ideas because of your experience in the 1960s, and what do you see as the continuities and discontinuities between those two eras?
Well, I mean, the book's really based on the kind of history that resulted from the existence of women's liberation as a movement. When I did my very early books, like Hidden from History, there was so little written. In some ways, it made it much easier because you could generalise clearly and simply without having so much literature to go on. But it also was a problem because we didn't have this great wealth of research that's existed since then. So I have, in in writing Dreamers of a New Day, I was able to draw on that, and it's bringing, I managed to bring a lot of it together. But I think that you're absolutely right, that the spirit behind it is the spirit that galvanized me in my youth, which was very much the 1960s, New Left, and the idea that there could be a form of a socialist society which was egalitarian and also free, not an oppressive kind of society. And it's certainly true that that kind of socialism, you know, has not ever really been put into practice. I think it's something that people have experienced in moments, in certain projects and things that they've experienced when they've been organising in a cooperative way, in a collective way. It's something which I think we felt in the very early days of the women's movement, a feeling of really open, free association. And in various movements, for example, when in the 1980s, when the miners resisted the closure of the pits that was introduced by the Conservative Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in Britain, we were also working, a lot of women worked with the women who organised in thousands in mining communities. And in some of those organisational experiences, there was definitely that open-hearted cooperation, which I associate with the with what I imagine to be socialism. So I do feel a personal involvement in some of the women in the book, but I am also a historian, so I did write about people who I probably am not so personally attracted to, like actually Beatrice Webb, who was much more of a top-down kind of socialist.
You quote in the book the American suffragist and novelist Winifred Harper Cooley talking about how the world might be 100 years from when she was writing, and she wrote this in 1902, so presumably about our time. And you write that she says the future will be revealed by a radiant woman in, quote, flowing, graceful robes, who explained that in 100 years' time, no one would be tramping the streets without a home or be unemployed. By then, the world's labor would be shared equally, so that each individual only worked 5 hours a day. And in our very explicitly anti-utopian era, I wonder if I could end by just asking you what you think of as the most utopian, and I mean that in a positive way, hopes about society that these generations of women held.
Yes, I think what it is that they have, which is so important, is this capacity to hope and to imagine that things can get better. And I fear that one of the terrible tricks that's been played since the idea of that kind of Keynesian social welfare kind of capitalism began to hit the dust, and this much more rapacious neoliberal kind of capitalism appears, we have really been taught to think that, you know, there really is no alternative and that it's impossible to make a change. And I think that because a whole my generation was completely geared to thinking, what do we do about state welfare kind of capitalism, how do we change that, when the capitalism changed gear, we were caught unawares. And I think it's been very difficult to create ideas of not simply what we're against, but what kind of society we actually want and need to replace capitalism, and also the practicalities of how we move from where we actually are now in this kind of global capitalism to a an alternative. And I'm afraid, whenever I go and speak on Dreamers of a New Day, people ask me all these totally difficult questions about what on earth to do about the present situation. And I unfortunately don't know the answers in a very neat way. But I do think that having that confidence to hope and imagine is ground that we need to reclaim. And so I hope that by writing this history, I would get the new generation aware of the stuff that's inspired my lot, but also to create a basis for saying, well, actually, they did it in the most incredibly difficult circumstances. Surely we can have a go and change what is.
Sheila Robotham, thank you so much. Today's guest has been Simon Research Professor at the University of Manchester, Sheila Robotham. Her many books include Edward Carpenter, A Life of Liberty and Love, Promise of a Dream, Remembering the 60s, and most recently, Dreamers of a New Day, Women Who Invented the 20th Century, published by Verso Books. You can find a link to those books at our website, againstthegrain.org. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thank you so much for listening. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Sung. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or look up Against the Grain Radio on Facebook.